DW Deutsche Welle. World in Progress.
In this edition, a new universal conscription law is changing politics in Israel.
You can do yeshiva, you can do both, yeshiva and army. And as well as you obedient to the rules of the Torah, you have to be obedient to the rules of the state.
We follow a local politician in his parliamentary election campaign in Papua New Guinea.
Like I put everything, I put my all ass basically on the election thing. And if I were to lose, kind of like lost everything too, you know.
And the plight of the Roma minority in Serbia.
It was a disaster on the day of the eviction. They bulldozed our house and we lived on the street for around 10 days before starting to build our new house.
Hello and welcome to World in Progress. I'm Anke Rasper in Bonn. Our first story today takes us to Israel. Shared rights, shared responsibilities. That's a basic democratic principle. But when it comes to universal conscription into the Israeli army, it's not so easy to implement. Bitter conflicts are emerging in Israel as political parties wrangle over rewriting the Tal law, which dictates who is conscripted and who is exempt from military service at the age of 18. As the clock ticks down to the 25th of July deadline for a new law to be passed, Orthodox Jews and Israeli Arabs are sticking to their figurative guns and resist the draft. The fragile coalition of Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu has already started to fall apart. Vanessa O'Brien has the story.
Aisha Torah Yeshiva boasts a backdrop that any Jewish seminary would envy. Its panoramic view encompasses the Western Wall and Temple Mount, Judaism's holiest sites, in the Jewish quarter of Jerusalem's Old City. Even the sweltering summer heat doesn't match the fiery debate of the yeshiva's students, as they sit for 10 or more hours a day to study the Jewish holy books, the Torah and the Tanakh. But today it's a secular law, the Tal law, that has Orthodox and ultra-Orthodox Jews in Israel, known as Haredim, concerned. Since the founding of the Israeli state in 1948, Haredim have been exempt from universal conscription for the purpose of studying Judaism. While other 18-year-old Israelis strap on their guns, young Haredim strap on their phylacteries, smaller the boxes that contain parchments of the Torah. Eish HaTorah Rabbi Shimon Horowitz says it's a tradition just as crucial to the defense of the Jewish state.
The Supreme Court uses the standard of equal burden. So that's exactly what I'm saying. There's a physical burden, secular Jews are handling that part, and there's a spiritual side of the burden, and religious Jews are handling that part. 64 years of wars here, a state of war, and how come we're still on the map? One could argue that it's this combination that has kept us successful, because most of the wars in Israel are fairly miraculous. Who cannot say it isn't not because of the yeshiva students learning and praying so that on the ground in the wars, the Jews were victorious.
However, in February of this year, Israel's High Court of Justice ruled that the Tal law, which allows full-time yeshiva students to defer army service, is unconstitutional. The government is struggling to write a new law that will garner enough support to keep the fractured coalition together and pass in the Knesset before it breaks for the summer on the 25th of July. If no new law is passed, in theory the state could draft about 62,000 yeshiva students and ultra-Orthodox youths this August, on top of the 7,000 yeshiva students who already serve. One compromise being tabled suggests deferring drafting Haredim until the age of 23. Rabbi Horowitz argues it won't work.
To get a knowledgeable Jewish population that can function with all the things we have to do as a observant Jew, I would say he has to at least learn for 10 years, 18 to 28, right? One of the things that the secular Jews do not know is that if you were talking to a medical student and he's in the middle of his studies, would you say, come on out and take 3 years off? Usually by that time, by the way, they will be married, probably, or could almost have a kid or two. The army really doesn't want married guys in the army.
Horowitz doesn't object to defending Israel with arms, but says it's also important to defend its Jewish identity through yeshiva. For Haredi man David Tamari, the two are not mutually exclusive. Tamari says he chose to serve as a captain in the Orthodox unit of the Israeli army from the age of 24.
You can do yeshiva, you can do both, yeshiva and army. And as well as you obedient to the rules of the Torah, you have to be obedient to the rules of the state. There is no contradiction. And you can go to the army because this is the rule. No asking questions and trying to be philosophical.
Military service for most Israelis is a rite of passage. Men serve for a minimum of 3 years from the age of 18 and women for 2 years. It's a shared experience, a joint sense of camaraderie and pride, and a point of entry into Israeli society. Almost every bus stop across the country has a group of young soldiers, guns slung over the shoulders, making the most of their free ticket to ride. Part of the rationale behind changing the Tal law is to integrate fringe groups, such as Haredim and Israeli Arabs, into this mainstream fold. However, Elad Shamir, manager of the Arab sector of Ha'agadah Lahitvadnut, an organization that manages civil service volunteers, says making service mandatory for Israeli Arabs would be counterproductive to building trust.
If you legislate or obligate the service now, it will finish it. If we wait 10 years, we'll have thousands, maybe hundreds of thousands of volunteers and families and villages, and the whole concept will be more understood. It's too early.
On the streets of East Jerusalem, few Israeli Arabs volunteer for military service, but there is a growing interest in civil service. Ha'agadah Lahitvadnut started managing volunteer service positions for Israeli Arabs just 4 years ago with 200 volunteers. Today it manages more than 2,400 Israeli Arab volunteers and has a waiting list of applicants. It's a program designed specifically for Israeli Arabs. The volunteers, 90% of whom are female, work in their own communities and villages in different sectors including health, education, civil administration, football coaching, and even firefighting. National service volunteers receive the same benefits as Israelis who serve in the army, including a 12,000 shekel one-time grant. That's about 2,500 euros towards starting out in life after 2 years of service. Israeli Arabs are beginning to recognize the benefits of serving, says Ha'agadah Lahitvadnut deputy manager of the Arab sector, Itamar Schwartz.
I think that for them, it's an option. Most of the girls, they don't really have a real good alternative. Usually they don't know Hebrew and it's hard for them to apply a job. It's hard for them to go study, or maybe their father don't want them to go study, I don't know. So it's an option for them to go to do something.
Not all Israeli Arabs feel the same though. Any kind of service in Israeli institutions is a travesty, says Mohammed Abu Omar, who owns a shop in Jerusalem's old city.
I think it's a disgrace for any Palestinian to serve in the Israeli army or in the army of the occupiers. And I always thought this is the biggest disgrace you can do, is to serve your occupier and serve in his army.
25-year-old Israeli Arab computer engineering student Ahmed Al-Hadari says any kind of service should be voluntary.
Actually, I think the government shouldn't let everyone to go to the service because everyone has the right to choose his way.
Down in the Mamilla Mall on the Jewish side of Jerusalem, Jewish Israeli Talia Marx has a different view.
I do believe that the people studying and the yeshiva students, I think they're doing a great service for the country in the spiritual way. And I think it has to be a combination between the combat units and the people sitting and praying for this country.
But like most secular Jewish people that DW spoke with on the street, Michael Millman says the Tal law should be one rule for all.
I think in principle, yeah, I think everybody should serve in principle.
Vanessa O'Brien, DW, Jerusalem.
Serbia's EU accession plans hang in the balance after the election of President Tomislav Nikolic, a former supporter of Milosevic and member of the ultra-nationalist party of Vojislav Šešelj, again placing the sensitive issue of Kosovo's independence high on the agenda. In Belgrade, large settlements of Roma people are being evicted with very little warning, no recourse and, at times, no alternative accommodation. This presents a particularly acute problem for refugees and internally displaced persons who can become essentially legally invisible. Daniel Bishton reports from Belgrade.
Here, among the towering concrete apartment blocks of New Belgrade, a Roma family has built a home from recycled materials, salvaged wood, steel, and bricks. Children run around barefoot among piles of refuse and rusting machinery. The temperature is 40 degrees Celsius in the shade, and the air heavy with the reek of human waste. Their previous home, in which they had lived for 13 years, was bulldozed in March this year during the eviction of Block 72, an informal settlement of Roma people that stood on what is now a construction site for high-rise apartments.
It was a disaster on the day of the eviction. They bulldozed our house, and we lived on the street for around 10 days before starting to build our new house.
Marco, whose name has been changed, is a refugee from the war in Kosovo, where Roma was seen by Albanian forces as being allied with the Serbs. Kosovo remains a dangerous place for Roma, Albanians and Serbs alike if they are minorities in their areas. And although the rate of returnees to the region has been increasing, it remains very low. Marco, his wife and their six children have no residence nor birth documents, effectively making them legally invisible in Serbia, with no access to legal aid or welfare. He tried to return to Kosovo in 2003 as the government provided him with a block of land under the property expropriation process.
The government built me a house in Kosovo and I returned there. But after a couple of days, some people came to find me from the other side and I had to leave again. I was scared. I just hope that no one will evict us again. If they do, I will have to build another house. I just hope that if I am evicted in the future, I can receive some accommodation because I can't return to Kosovo.
His situation illustrates the statelessness that faces many Kosovo Roma in Serbia. Official sources estimate the number of Roma refugees from Kosovo at around 20,000, while NGOs claim that the figure's closer to 40,000. Often uneducated and without documentation, many of these live in the informal settlements of central Belgrade, where they're able to scrape together an existence by scouring the city's streets and rubbish bins for raw materials to be recycled or sold. Local legal aid NGO Praxis has counted a total of 17 major evictions of these settlements since 2009 that they claim violate multiple international human rights accords. These evictions and their aftermath have become a sensitive political issue at all levels of government, as I discovered when I visited the Belleville informal settlement and found my access blocked by a private security guard, working under contract for the city of Belgrade specifically to prevent journalists entering the site. Eventually, two NGO representatives are allowed in to provide legal advice to families in the settlement, but I am told to wait outside. One possible reason for the increased security at Belleville is that this settlement is being closely watched by international stakeholders. Whilst hundreds of families were evicted from this site in April, some cling on in uncertain hope. Those that remain here have not yet been evicted because the city of Belgrade has borrowed from the European Investment Bank for the construction of an access road where their homes now stand. As a condition for the loan, the city must provide permanent housing to those they evict, and the European Commission has provided 3.5 million euros for this purpose. Danilo Čorčić, a legal analyst with NGO Praxis, says that this forces the city's hand.
This is the conclusion after the monitoring from all the other evictions. If there is some money or influence or pressure from international organizations or European Union or European Investment Bank, then all the families will be provided with some kind of assistance, with alternative accommodations or whatever else. But if there is not, then representatives, the authorities could do whatever they want with this eviction.
The former residents of Block 72 weren't so lucky. Some of those with Belgrade residence papers were moved into steel shipping containers on the outskirts of the city. Those originally from Kosovo were told to return home, and if unwilling, were offered temporary accommodation in refugee processing centres, often hundreds of kilometres from Belgrade with no work opportunities. Many families, like Marco's, found themselves on the street. Čorčić says that even for those that qualified for container settlements, conditions were below minimum human rights standards.
It's not really adequate and suitable for living. It's 16 square meters for five people. And we know that in prisons there is standards for more than that. So basically prison standards are bigger than standards for housing for Rome. Also, all the settlements are on the outskirts of Belgrade. There is also one settlement which is made for Belleville families. It is 50 kilometers from center of the Belgrade, and it's in the middle of swamp, where it's just they just put the dirt and put the metal containers in this. Also, there is no any shade in any of the settlements there, and just it's really too hot in during the summer. Also, in winter, it's too cold because there is no isolation, and basically, it's kind of a segregated settlement which is designed only for Roma to live there.
At the Block 72 site, I met Buya Suleimani. His family now lives in the nearest container settlement to the city centre, but he still has to ride for 2 hours each day to the site of his former home so that he can collect materials to sell. I asked him how his family copes with the Belgrade summer's sweltering heat.
Ventilator.
It's over 50 degrees inside the container and my baby cannot sleep. I bought an electric fan for 1,800 dinars, but it cannot help. It is really, really hot. The baby cannot sleep.
Despite this, he is happy with his new accommodation and is complying with the nebulously worded conditions for remaining in the settlement, which include being courteous and polite to city officials. His family has clean water and electricity, and his children will attend school when they are of age.
Hygiene, water, electricity, and everything is fine, but the problem is work. Also, we will be removed from this settlement next year, but I don't know when that will happen or where we will go.
The authority responsible for Block 72's eviction, the Directorate for Minorities and Human Rights, declined to be interviewed for this report. But they've previously described Block 72's eviction as an example of good practice. Churchitz says that without a legally binding framework and the political will to implement a humane and sustainable approach to Roma people in Serbia, all they can do is watch the evictions from the sidelines and provide relief once they've been carried out.
With this situation, the legal framework, they will be in this situation for years because there is no law just not recognizing their problems. If we are lucky, we will get information from people that are living in settlements, but if we are not, then we can just watch the eviction and try to put some public pressure from the media, and that's it. Basically, as if City of Belgrade, of Republic of Serbia, all the authorities would even map all the settlements in Serbia and then classify them by the living conditions, that would just be a first step in starting to deal with this really huge problem, because right now we don't know what will happen in next 3 months in any municipality in Serbia.
In the meantime, thousands of Belgrade's Roma remain in deep poverty and legal purgatory with few avenues of recourse. Daniel Bishton, Deutsche Welle, Belgrade.
Coming up next here on World in Progress, a report about the election campaign in Papua New Guinea. But first, here's Roger Coelho with a look at some development news.
China's leader warns unemployment is getting worse. China's premier Wen Jiabao warned Tuesday the country was facing a more severe employment situation as the world's second largest economy slows. Wen said China had created 98 million new jobs between 2003 and 2011, but would have to work harder to find jobs for its growing workforce. In particular, it needs jobs for its 250 million migrant workers and 40 million college graduates. He added the country's unemployment situation would become more complicated and said job creation was considered a top priority for the government. Human rights group slams Oman for crackdown on free expression. Amnesty International slammed Omani authorities for convicting activists who were peacefully exercising their right to freedom of expression. They faced jail terms on charges including publicly insulting the Sultan, as well as using the internet to publish defamatory and insulting materials. These sentences are the latest phase in the Omani government's orchestrated crackdown on freedom of expression and assembly, said Amnesty's Middle East director, Philip Luther. Amnesty added that all charges leveled against the activists must be dropped. Contested UNESCO prize awarded amid boycott. After years of debate, UNESCO has awarded research prizes from Equatorial Guinea to three scholars. The ceremony was boycotted by some Western delegations, which maintain that the prize money, some $3 million, comes from a corrupt regime. The UNESCO Obiang International Prize for Research in the Life Sciences is named after President Obiang, Africa's longest-ruling dictator. He's part of Equatorial Guinea's ruling clan, but the oil-rich country has a poor human rights record and has been named as the most poorly governed country of all those surveyed for the UN Human Development Report, which measured the discrepancy between available wealth and development. Despite this, some African nations continue to see the prize as a point of pride for a continent sorely in need of world respect. World Bank approves contentious Ethiopia-Kenya electric line. The World Bank has approved funding credit for a major transmission line that would link Kenya to the controversial Gilgel-Gibeah 3 dam site in southern Ethiopia. This despite months of calls from rights and environmental groups that the World Bank stay away from the project. The move, announced last week, is complicated by the fact that the bank has already refused to fund the dam itself, citing lack of transparency. The African Development Bank and the European Investment Bank have also pulled out, although the project is going ahead with funding from the Industrial and Commercial Bank of China. The dam will be 240 meters tall when it is done and has been under construction since 2006. It is currently about halfway done and should be finished by 2014. The transmission line could be up and running by 2018.
That was Saroja Coelho with the development news. A season of election wrapped up last week in the democratic nation of Papua New Guinea. Just 37 years into its independent history, it's a nation still very much sorting through what the newfound freedom means. For 6 weeks, reporter Emily Richmond hit the campaign trail with East New Britain regional candidate Levi Orong. What follows is a story of democracy unlike any other place in the world.
Home and come, someone says, you know, they picked up something, like somebody's trying to knock me out using black magic, you know, stuff like that. It works here. What I'm saying, we'll try and knock it off, but you be careful, just be careful.
The man speaking, MP candidate Levi Orong, is a local politician in his early 40s. He knows that here, in the islands region of Papua New Guinea, in this land of the unexpected, you've got to be prepared for anything. In a country with over 800 different tribes, 800 different languages, cultures, customs, it's one of the most diverse nations on the planet. Everywhere you go, you hear stories. Dwarves and giants, magic birds, creation myths, black Jesus, cargo cults. This one, though, is a story of a man who in many ways is in a similar position as the nation itself, standing at a crossroads, looking this way and that, desperately trying to make sense of the options.
You know, the strange thing is that I want to go to parliament and I also don't want to go to parliament. I'm just going to miss a lot of things. The best things in life, I'm going to miss them. Like love, for example. Because then you never know who's there because of your status or who's there because they really love you, you know?
I'm just a sucker for love, I guess. It hasn't happened right for me yet, I guess.
To his usual combo of blue jeans and a black polo with his party's insignia, he's also added his good luck charm, a snake bone necklace from his tribal childhood. Things back then were much simpler for Levi. He grew up in a tiny coastal village of the Binings tribe and spent his youth swimming coral reefs and climbing coconut trees to get a better view of airplanes soaring overhead, his then only connection to the modern world. Levy's come a long way. He's educated and wealthy, and winning the seat would be a first for the Binings in parliament. He's tried twice before. This is his last go. We're sitting in his clanky white Nissan truck on a side street in Kokopo, the heart of the province capital. It's Levi's part of town. Levi shouts to an old man carrying some baskets across the street.
Uncle, come on, sir.
Thank you.
A Coca-Cola, something for lunch, that's how much money he just gave him. It's a simple exchange, but it's something that's part of a much larger and more complex problem in Papua New Guinea. Corruption and the buying of votes.
Thank you.
Another day, another set of rounds. We're driving down the main drag and Levy pulls off into the shoulder of the road, dead center in front of the local prison. Across the yard, you see countless straggly limbs hanging through the bars.
These are top criminals. Jesus. Look at his face.
A couple rough-looking guys are milling around in the street. They recognize his car and head over for instruction.
Hey! Mitulon na parek sa rondon ko, na parek sa baitla bago loya baga ka. I'm talking Finnish. Okay, good.
He's your friend, or how do you know him?
Well, those are my boys.
What does that mean?
It basically means they're working for me during the elections. And they just walk up to, so you know, they like to do it their own way.
Election campaigns here don't run with campaign managers or clever PR guys with Twitter campaigns and Facebook pages to roll out. The social networking here is done at the street level, and cash is the main connection. Today, he's giving this ex-felon friend of his some travel money. He wants him to visit the outskirts, the bush, organize some of the rough-and-tumble kids there, use his street clout to influence their vote. Levy has countless guys like this. Any given day, we might meet with 15 to 20 of these, what he calls coordinators. And so far, it's cost him a lot of cash. He says he's put in nearly 250,000 kina of his own money thus far. That's 120,000 euros, and at this point, he's pretty much spent.
70,000 in about 2 months, right? That's the kind of momentum I'm talking about, like 35 Gs a month.
Officially, Levy is self-employed, describing his most recent occupation as a sort of consultant to some of the foreign logging companies operating here. And according to several transparency organizations, many politicians with such connections routinely receive handsome funds in exchange for help smoothing business. It's all on the sly, it's all cash. The exact numbers are hard to know. According to a recent review by the COG, the Commonwealth Observer Group, this year's elections, however, have seen an even higher than normal rate of bribery and intimidation. But Levy doesn't buy what all the fuss is about.
Transparency and good governance, those are admirable traits, except we all come from different backgrounds, right? What is good to you may not necessarily be good to me. What is polite to you may not necessarily be polite to me.
He says the way money is used here would be completely foreign to the Western world. The culture here is a gift culture, and things given for free shouldn't be judged so harshly.
Yeah, that's the whole thing. We are not bad people. We are made out to be bad people.
The weeks are winding down, and Levy's party, NA, National Alliance, is yet to come through with a single dollar of the promised financial support for his campaign.
Like, I put everything, I put my all ass, basically, on the election thing. And if I were to lose, kind of like lost everything too, you know.
I ask Levy why he has no posters up when the campaign period is halfway over and all the other candidates have been plastering the town. He's thinking of dropping out entirely.
Sometimes I sit down and I think to myself, what the hell am I doing? You know, like I shouldn't have started. You know, I could do a lot of things. Like I could save this money that I'm spending for something good. I've been actually thinking about going over to Australia or New Zealand, getting a pilot's license, maybe buy myself a small plane, or maybe I could go for studies, you know? Man, I can visit you in America, then maybe I find a girlfriend there.
In the end, Levy saw the elections through, ran his campaign hard till the very end. As of reporting, votes are still being counted. In a world where everything seems to be changing at a breakneck pace, most folks here are just hoping the growing pains are going to pass. Emily Richman, DW, Kokopo, Papua New Guinea.
And this report from Papua New Guinea wraps up today's edition of World in Progress. Thanks for joining me today. We'll be back next week at the same time. Until then, you can listen to these reports or find out more about other topics online at dw.de/globalization. For today, on behalf of our Bonn studio team, Eliane Giaducci and Melanie Schlicht, I'm Anke Rasper saying thanks for listening and goodbye.